This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Wahib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
What we've historically seen is that when you have these moments of conflict, moments of political tension, particularly when a state of emergency is declared, this reverberates back on the media community, on journalists.
That was Committee to Protect Journalists Representative Mutoki Mumo urging Ethiopian authorities to release journalists arrested after a state of emergency was declared. Details coming up. Also, the Group of 20 or G20 summit starts tomorrow in New Delhi. And Liberia's President George Weah officially launched his campaign for a second term. These stories and more on African News Tonight. But first, our top story. A U.S. drone base known as Air Base 201 was built near Agadez in central Niger at a cost of more than $100 million. Since 2018, it has been used to target Islamic State and Al-Qaeda affiliate Jamaatu Nusrat al-Islam wal-Muslimin in the Sahel. U.S. officials say after Niger's recent coup, the Pentagon is repositioning some troops and equipment within Niger and will withdraw a small number of non-essential personnel out of abundance of caution. To brief us more on the matter, we have VOA's Pentagon correspondent, Carla Babb, on the line. Welcome to African News Tonight, Carla.
Thanks for having me.
So talk to us about this repositioning by the Pentagon in Niger.
Okay, so just to bring context to the situation, the U.S. has about 1,100 U.S. military personnel inside Niger. And so what they are doing is they are moving some, out of abundance of caution, according to the Pentagon, out of Air Base 101 near the capital and, you know, nearly 1,000 kilometers to the northwest to Air Base 201 in Agadez. They have stressed that there's no threat of violence on the ground. It's just simply a precautionary measure. And another thing that I'm hearing, the U.S. military had moved what the Pentagon Deputy Press Secretary had called non-essential personnel out in July. I just want to clarify this. I'm hearing from one official, and they said that they're going back to double-check the numbers, but it appears that, you know, fewer than 20 U.S. service members have actually left since the coup began, and these were all due to medical issues that they had or regular scheduled mission rotations. So up until this point, since this incident that happened, there really haven't been any force posture changes to U.S. forces up until this moment where they're shifting more from the base near the capital to Agadez, Air Base 201.
So it's understandable this consolidation represents planning to safeguard U.S. assets, but will the U.S. still address the threat of violent extremism in the region?
Well, that is the major issue here, because what I am hearing and what VOA has exclusively heard from multiple U.S. officials is that the drones that have been based in Niamey and based in Agadez, those drone flights have been limited since the July coup. And officials and former officials are worried that this could really hinder the international counterterrorism mission in West Africa. Because, I mean, just think about it. Niger, our audience knows this. Niger is the U.S. military's hub for counterterror intelligence, reconnaissance, and surveillance, not just in Niger, but in the entire region that covers Chad, that covers Nigeria. I mean, it's just, it has a massive amount of reach. And so the concern is that if there's fewer eyes in the skies because there's less drones launching from these bases to conduct these surveillance and these intelligence missions, then that is making it more difficult for partners on the ground to keep up with these terrorist groups.
And the administration of President Joe Biden has not formally labeled the military takeover in Niger as a coup. So this a designation that would limit what security assistance Washington can provide the country. So would that help?
That's right. As soon as the Biden administration were to call this a coup, that would severely restrict the amount of aid that they can receive and the military cooperation there. That is a huge problem because Niger is home to the base in Niamey, the base in Agadez, and those are basically the only areas where the U.S. can launch these drones for counterterrorism operations, for eyes in the skies, over all of these groups that have just infiltrated West Africa over the last few years. Yes, they have some ability in Somalia. Yes, the U.S. military has some ability in Djibouti. There's the only U.S. base on the continent is in Djibouti that is, you know, officially the U.S. base. And maybe they could pull in some resources from Italy, but you're talking about nowhere else really that the U.S. has to launch these drones and to conduct these intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance missions that not only help the United States and international partners keep an eye on these terror groups, but also help the local populations keep an eye on this terror group. And I was talking to some experts here in Washington, and they point to the situation last month where about 17 or 18 Nigerian forces were killed by Islamist groups that ambushed them. They point to all of this increased violence by these terror groups in the region, and they say, look, you know, if you can't fly drones to see what's happening, you're going to have more and more violence. So they're very concerned that the situation will only further deteriorate unless the U.S. can get more drones up in the air.
Fantastic. VOA's Pentagon correspondent Carla Bob, thank you for your input.
Thanks for having me.
Liberia's President George Weah officially has launched his campaign for a second term ahead of next month's elections in front of thousands of supporters in the capital, Monrovia. Supporters of the former international football star began descending on a stadium in central Monrovia at dawn yesterday for the event. Weah told the crowd that during his first term, his administration has laid the foundations for peace, freedom of speech, macroeconomic stability, and restoring confidence in the national educational system. Weah has promised to create jobs and invest in education, but his critics accuse him of failing to deliver. 20 presidential candidates are competing to lead the country of about 5 million. Many Liberians say the rising cost of living and concerns over corruption are key issues. Many are also worried about possible electoral violence in the country, which suffered back-to-back civil wars between 1989 and 2003 that left more than 250,000 people dead. Members of the International Radio and Television Union say shortfalls of infrastructure and human and financial resources hamper the switch from analog to digital broadcasting in public media, especially in Africa. At a meeting this week in Cameroon, they called on governments and funding agencies to help with digitalization, which they say is a must in the changing media landscape. Mokedwin Kindeka reports from Yaoundé that more than half of Africa's media is yet to fully digitalize.
Many member states in the International Radio and Television Union, URTI, say funding and human capital, which is at the very core of transformation from analog to digital broadcasting, are still very absent in their respective countries. Meeting in Yaoundé this week, public broadcast managers said increasing reports of cross-interference between broadcasting and telecom services is a direct consequence of switchover delays. Professor Amin Alassane is the Director General of Ghana Broadcasting Corporation. He says most African broadcasters are not serving their audiences and staying relevant in a changing media landscape as they should, because of the slow pace of digital transformation.
Public media stations across the world are very old. They have heavy investment in analog media and also analog media expertise. Our staff are used to analog system, and to translate it into a digital ecosystem is a challenge. So our challenge is, how do you transform our existing staff to have a mindset change to understand the operations of digital media?
The International Telecommunication Union, or ITU, says digital broadcasting allows stations to offer higher definition video and better sound quality than analog. Digital broadcasting also offers multiple channels of programming on the same frequency. In 2006, the ITU set June 2015 as the deadline for all broadcasting stations in the world transmitting on the UHF band used for television broadcasting to switch from analog to digital. A 5-year extension to June 2020 was given for VHF band stations mostly used in FM broadcasting to switch over. But the URTI says most of Africa missed the deadline, did not turn off analog television signals, and is missing the advantages of digital broadcasting. Mauritius, Kenya, Tanzania, and Uganda are among the first African countries to complete the switch. South Africa said in 2022 it would finally switch to digital TV on March 31, 2023. Jacqueline Frongwane, programming manager of SABC, South Africa's public broadcaster, attended the Yaoundé meeting. She says the switchover process is still ongoing after the deadline.
Towards the end of last year, just before the Soccer World Cup, we were able to launch our own OTT platform. We're really, really excited about this because it's been something that we've been working on for a very, very long time. South African audiences, for now, can get access to content, which means that as a public broadcaster, we are also moving towards digitization of content.
Frongwane said OTT platforms provide television content over the internet at the request of users and viewers. Public broadcasters say governments and funding agencies should help them with infrastructure and human and financial resources to increase digital penetration on the continent, which is estimated at between 30% and 43%, below the global average of about 70%. Mokki Edwin Kinzuka, VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
The Group of 20 or G20 summit starts tomorrow as most of the world's leading economies gather in New Delhi. The sole African voice in the bloc belongs to South Africa, but other members, including the United States, are pushing for the inclusion of the African Union. Darren Taylor reports on some of the issues likely to be raised that are important to Africa.
Some G20 members, including India and South Africa, are pressing the bloc to help reform global financial institutions such as the World Bank, so borrowing terms are better suited to capacities of less developed nations. Several African nations are struggling under heavy debts as interest rates rise and the US dollar strengthens. Matteo Villa, senior research fellow at the Italian Institute for International Political Studies in Milan, says Italy already is pushing for this at the Paris Club of Western Creditors. But, says Villa, the club's attempts to find solutions to the debt crisis are undermined by what he calls the big elephant in the room.
It is bound to fail because there is another fracture that China actually holds most of the debt of heavily indebted countries. Two-thirds of the debt is Chinese, almost one-third is Paris Club, and then there is multilateral institutions.
China has consistently said it will not discuss debt relief at forums such as the G20 and will instead talk with individual debtors about possible repayment restructuring. Villa was among several policy analysts speaking Thursday on a webinar organized by the South African Institute of International Affairs. Several G20 members say they want rich countries to fulfill their 2009 pledges to transfer $100 billion a year to help developing countries cope with climate change. The United Nations says African nations contribute the least to the carbon emissions that cause climate change, but suffer the most from its effects: drought, storms, and floods. Fabio Suarez, Director of International Studies at the Institute of Applied Economic Research in Rio de Janeiro, says Brazil intends to focus on making sure efforts to slow climate change don't hamper development.
Of course, Brazil supports the whole climate action, but we are really concerned about development being forgotten in this process. So we need to make sure that not only the energy transition, but the ecological transition comes in a way that it doesn't jeopardize the right to develop that all countries have.
On a broader front, the director of the South African Institute of International Affairs, Elizabeth Sidiropoulos, says the G20 is deeply divided.
The lessons we have learned from the last 2 years of the Ukraine war, and something that I think has shocked Europe and North America, is the way in which the developing countries have positioned themselves, whether non-aligned or a little lukewarm, you know, voting in favor of a resolution but not implying sanctions. In Europe, a sense that Europe has lost the global south.
South Africa is the sole African voice in the G20, but that should change soon, as members are expected to approve, including the African Union. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011.
The Committee to Protect Journalists, or CPJ, is urging Ethiopia to release at least two journalists who were jailed after the government declared a six-month state of emergency to halt deadly fighting in northern Amhara state. CPJ Sub-Saharan Africa representative Motiki Mumo tells VOA's Carol Van Dam that Ethiopian authorities also detained journalists ahead of a planned demonstration against the region's interim administration led by the Tigray People's Liberation Front.
The context of this situation is really that there's a state of emergency that was recently declared in Ethiopia, in parts of Ethiopia, amid an ongoing conflict in Amhara. And what we've historically seen is that when you have these moments of conflict, moments of political tension, particularly when a state of emergency is declared, this reverberates back on the media community, on journalists. We see that space closing down. We see journalists being arrested. And unfortunately, the current situation is no surprise. So since the state of emergency was declared, we've documented so far four arrests. There was one earlier arrest in early August of a journalist called Bekalu Alamro, who works with an online outlet called Alpha Media. Bekalu remains detained. We understand he has since been transferred to a military base far from Addis Ababa, which is where he was detained. More recently, we have documented three more arrests. As you rightly mentioned, one of those arrested is Abai Zaidu, who's the chief editor of a YouTube-based broadcaster called Amhara Media Center. He was arrested on August 10th and initially detained in Addis Ababa, but he has since been transferred again outside of Addis Ababa. We've also documented the arrest of two other journalists, Fekadu Matemawok and Yid Nekachu Kebede. Fortunately, both of them have been released without being charged.
So how many journalists are still in detention right now?
I cannot say definitively because there are always cases we may not have heard of or may not have documented. What I can say is that from the cases we've documented since August, two journalists remain behind bars, and that's Abai Zaidu and Bekalu Alamru, who again are detained, as far as we know, they've been taken from Addis Ababa, which is where they've been arrested and been taken to a military base, military facility away from the city. But again, I would like to emphasize that this might not be fully holistic, fully representative of what is going on in Ethiopia currently. So, for instance, just over the last few days, it has been reported to us that some journalists may have been detained while reporting protests in Tigray, which is in northern Ethiopia. That's an unrelated situation.
We've heard about that in Tigray. We've heard about where they were doing planned demonstrations, and then ahead of the demonstrations, these journalists were also detained. Do you know if they were beaten at all or were they roughed up at all?
So we are aware, we've received this report, but I cannot say much because we're trying to investigate to really understand what happened, to understand if they were detained in connection to their work. We understand that some people were assaulted, beaten during those protests. We're trying to determine if that includes the journalists and to understand if the journalists were detained. But this, for me, just highlights the fact that, you know, we've documented a couple of cases, but it's difficult to fully understand the depth and the breadth of what is happening to journalists who are trying to report in Ethiopia right now.
That was Mutoki Mumo, the Sub-Saharan Africa representative for the Committee to Protect Journalists. She was speaking to VOA's Carol Van Dam from Nairobi. Ethiopian Embassy in Washington, D.C. did not reply to VOA's email request for comment. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest development on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Cornelius Tanner, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
An editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Nature crime is defined as engagement in the illegal acquisition, trade, and trafficking of wildlife, wildlife parts and products, illicit logging and mining, crimes associated with fishing, and the illegal activities with which they converge. And it is a very big business. Ranking as the world's fourth most lucrative transnational crime, it yields $110 to $281 billion worth of profit every year. That is why the governments of Gabon, Norway, the United Kingdom, and the United States, along with the United Nations and several law enforcement agencies, non-governmental organizations, and civil society groups, got together to form the Nature Crime Alliance. Launched in late August, the Alliance is a global, multi-sector network that aims to mobilize governments, non-governmental organizations, and the private sector and ramp up efforts to disrupt the criminal networks engaged in nature crimes. We recognize that these crimes cannot be eradicated without multi-sector cooperation, and that there is a pressing need for greater coordination and collaboration among the diverse actors fighting nature crime. A new approach is needed, said the founding members in a joint statement issued at the launching of the alliance. We have formed the alliance in recognition of this need, with members including representatives from government, law enforcement, international organizations, civil society organizations, frontline defenders, including indigenous peoples, and local communities, donors, and the private sector, said the statement. Nature crimes threaten our collective security, said Jennifer Littlejohn, Acting Assistant Secretary for Oceans and International Environmental and Scientific Affairs at the United States Department of State. They undermine the rule of law, fuel corruption, destroy ecosystems, and drive species to the brink of extinction, all the while providing billions of dollars to transnational criminal syndicates that prey upon the world's most vulnerable populations. Indeed, nature crimes are enormously destructive. They rob communities of their livelihoods and natural resources, spread disease, destroy ecosystems, and push species to the brink of extinction. It is also important to note that such crimes do not exist in a vacuum. They frequently go hand in hand with crimes such as trafficking in persons, antiquities, and drugs and guns, as well as corruption, extortion and bribery, money laundering, and fraud. We all must stand together to stop the criminals who are threatening the health of this planet, said Jennifer Littlejohn, and that is why the United States is proud to support the Nature Crime Alliance.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.